these are just two little ways of schematizing the fundamental structure that Hegel's looking at. I'm going to go leap right into the chapter and then come back to some of the stuff on action we were talking about at the end last week. But I'm bound to forget to talk about action, so please remind me to do it. But I just didn't want to delay getting into the chapter itself. And for me, this is the highlight, in a way, of the book. When I first read Hegel as part of a crazy reading group in Edinburgh, of course I was gripped by the master-slave dialectic and reading Heidegger. But the moment of reading this chapter, the moment when suddenly, in the middle of a philosophy text all about conceptuality and dialectic, suddenly this woman appears. I just had prickles on the back of my neck. It just meant that somehow philosophy was different than I ever imagined it could be. That somehow a philosophy text to think about the meaning of being in general should have to think about Antigone. Have to think about Antigone. Struck me as extraordinary and still does. And all other philosophies I know of, none of them reach this level of concreteness. This level of letting an individual, and an individual, as it turns out, a fictional individual, have this role. But Hegel just takes her as if she is this individual who is central for thinking about the meaning of the fundamental categories necessary for self-understanding for us Westerners. He just plainly thinks that, and I'm going to actually suggest that the chapter on spirit is about her, and therefore that, in a way, the book is about her. Vindicating Antigone could have been the title of the book, on my reading of it. So a few promissory notes then. Nothing I said can live up to that, but start with. So the chapter on ethical life, on the Greeks, is divided into two parts. The chapter as a whole is divided into three parts, two parts on Greece, one part on Rome. Rome solves all the problems that didn't get solved in Greece. Don't forget about Rome. The ethical order, the first part, is an attempt to display Greek life through the way in which it was romanticized by German philosophy. It's not an historical account, but it's the account of Germany necessary for our historical retrospection. It's the way in which Greek ethical life enters into our Western self-consciousness. and it is an image of the Greek world as utterly harmonious and unified society. That's what I was trying to schematize here a bit. Right? I'll say more about that. It is, finally, Hegel is going to complain, an aesthetic description, and untrue. Well, what was it about the Greek world that made a claim to something that could be called post-Kantian? And the answer, we've already seen last week, week before even, is that it is a movement into the sociality of reason. The sociality of reason, reason as worked out, I need somebody to get things by that phrase, in part it means the rationality of our everyday life worked out by the structure of our fundamental institutions and the nature of our self-conception as it is derived from our participation in those institutions and our understanding of ourselves as such participants. So the sociality of reason is the rationality implicit in our practices, and that we have no access to our self-understanding independently of those practices and the way in which they structure a totality. That need not be explicit, and in fact, it almost never is. That's part of Hegel's story. I'll mention it, and then you can just worry about it. Hegel thinks that art, what we think of as art, did not become art until there was no longer art. That is, art only emerges after it's eclipsed by philosophy as authoritative. So the meaning of the being of a practice is known only retrospectively, right? And was opaque in its practice. That would be a course on lectures on aesthetics. Although there is a new translation of a book out that deals with that thought itself very nicely, called The End of Art by Eva Goylin, which talks about Hegel and Nietzsche and Adorno. Who else? And Danto, yes. That renegade Hegelian in Columbia, yeah. So, the sociality of reason is what makes it, in the sense I've just indicated, post-Kantian, and that sociality appears as an aesthetic image. The ethical realm, Hegel says in paragraph 463, is in this way an enduring existence, an immaculate world, a world unsullied by any internal dissension. Now, that's not Hegel's own voice. That's the voice he's ventriloquizing. He doesn't really think that's the way it was, right? But he thinks that that was the image that he was taking up. And he's going to try to think about why one could have that image, and he has a theory about that. In fact, a very complicated theory, of which there are two parts I'll come to. And nonetheless, even with support, it's false. But the idea behind it is that this is a simple truth that will fall apart. But the simple truth itself presupposes, if you wish, some form of functional structural equilibrium. is a model of, so it's as if Talcott Parsons, if he could have invented a perfectly functional society where each of the bits perfectly was functional for all the other bits, he would have imagined ancient Greece. That's the idea. And then Greek tragedy is going to be from the get-go, and it's one of the mysteries about the German understanding of ancient Greece as beautiful, is that they read Greek tragedies and they knew that the Greeks didn't think that. Right? So, it all kind of hinges on Winckelmann looking at sculptures. I don't know how it got going, but it has something deep to do with Winckelmann and the way in which he then influenced the take-up. Okay, well, Greek tragedy, particularly in Aeschylus and Sophocles, emerges, in fact, at a moment of crisis in Greek society. It emerges at that moment of transition between two competing social forms, but at a moment in which those two competing social forms coexisted and interpenetrated with one another, that they had reached a kind of equilibrium of a kind, or at least a working compromise. The older social form is that of a society based essentially on the family, or the tribe, but a primitive social unit, in which the organizational forms were religious in character, and that in this ancient or older social form, the structure of property rights and the structure of how things got distributed, worked through matrilineal descent. In sociology, anthropology, kinship systems, you can either follow, everything either can follow mom or follow dad. Following mom is called matrilineal descent, following dad is called patrilineal descent, and needless to say, the transition from one to the other has a bit of contest about it. We know that, and this should help answer some of the questions about the brother-sister thing, that matrilineal descent is based on the idea of the mother's line and on female procreative power. The brother-sister relationship is basic here. The word for brother in ancient Greek is adelphos. For sister Adelphé, both of them are derivatives of the Greek Delphus from the word womb. That is, they shared a womb. Right? They are connected in that way. The it hence is natural, because these were matrilineal descents, that in this older set up, and as it then comes to play a role in this moment of crisis, the role of women is to be spokesmen of the divine, of the old religion, and to play out its obligations in the family. The new form, the new form, of course, is the polis, or the nation, a collection of families. And the particular representative now is going to be the male citizen. And as Hegel puts it, the notion of political organization was so rudimentary that they hadn't yet figured out bad modes of inequality and hierarchy. So they just had democracy, as it were, as a spontaneous. Why not, right? We're all heads of our family. We're all, It just like it took time before they realized that there could be much nastier ways of organizing a political world, all of which the Romans managed by themselves. Right? They didn't leave any behind. And just when you're reading, the interesting thing is Aeschylus is the most sensitive to the debate. I read Aeschylus as a defender of the city against the older religion. Conversely, Sophocles, who's a slightly later writer, is more suppressed about it, but it's all over Sophocles, above all in Antigone. And when you read Sophocles, you have to remember he is, for his age, a neoconservative. Right? He is defending the old religion. Right? He's the Jerry Falwell of tragedians. Well, you miss some of the... you get wrong some of the emphases in Sophocles if you don't see what he's up to as a kind of religious reactionary. Okay. The whole, and I want to underline this because it's going to come back and haunt us, but it's obvious already, and that's why I wanted to set it up this way. Matrilineal descent, patrilineal descent, the entire structure of this society between now the older religious setup and the new political setup is nonetheless structured along a sexual division of labor. So that a natural distinction between men and women is used as a ordering device in order to set up the actual mechanisms of social relations between family and state. In paragraph 448, Hegel says remarkably little about the nation. He says, but what he does say is important for us, he says it is in the form of universality. It is, and this matters, I guess, to Hegel, it is the known law. And hence, based on prevailing custom, and in the form of individuality, it is the actual certainty of itself in the individual as such, and the certainty of itself as a simple individuality is that spirit as government. So the thought is, it's individuals are individual citizens, and their individuality gets recognized through their participation in government, each with an equal voice and all that. In his lectures on the philosophy of history, Hegel says that the Greeks occupy the middle ground of beauty, roughly between symbolic beauty and modern romantic beauty. In his I can't go through the whole thing, but his aesthetics, there are three ages of art: the symbolic, the classical, and the romantic. And this really goes to the ancient Eastern religions. Classical is the Greeks, the Romans. And by romantic, he means Christian and post-Christian art. As we know, for Christianity means, for Hegel, finally Lutheranism, which ultimately means modernity. Mm. the reason I mention this is because, however high the classical, and Hegel is some sort of classicist as an aesthetician, however high it is a moment which has not yet attained the standpoint of truth, and the reason it has not done so is because Greeks performed justice according to custom and habit, and they do not yet possess a conception of subjectivity. So Hegel, and now I'm quoting Hegel, that these forms, custom, habit, is the solid element, blah, blah, does not yet include reflection or the subjectivities of the will, the enemies of immediateness. Subjectivity, freedom of the will, reflection are enemies of immediateness. And I'll explain what that means in a moment. The public interest can therefore be entrusted to the will and decisions of the citizens. The Greek constitution must be democratic, for no principle yet exists which might oppose the ethical will or prevent its realization. There aren't any classes yet, for example. The citizens are not yet aware of the particular or therefore of evil. I think the first hint of evil in Greek literature, something we can recognize as evil, is probably, and I guess maybe in Euripides. Maybe, if anywhere. If there, right? But they don't really have that concept, and we'll see it's an important idea for Hegel. Among them, objective will has not yet been shattered. The goddess Athena is Athens itself. That is the real and concrete spirit of citizens. But divinity ceases to reside among the citizens when the will withdraws into itself, into its inaccessible refuge of knowledge and consciousness, and establishes the infinite separation between the subjective and the objective. The Greeks know nothing of what we think of or call subjectivity or inwardness, and because of this, it's this that allows a spontaneous democracy. And it's this that, therefore, permits the thought that one can identify oneself fully and unproblematically with the ethical totality. The poor point is, there's nothing for you not to identify with because there is no you apart from your role in society. So because there's no inwardness, there's no subjectivity, there's no individual having an interest apart from the collective interest, then there is nowhere further for nothing to block that sense that one's entire self is expressed in one's fulfilling of one's social duties. So the difference between social duties and individual duties does not yet exist. Hegel does have a lot to say. I'm going to come back to this argument in a moment, but let me just say a bit more about the structure. Hegel does have a lot to say about the family. He asks the question, what is the family for? And he then goes on to rehearse a whole bunch of possible answers, which he thinks are inadequate. So you might think that the essence of the family is love. But that doesn't quite work, because the family is an institution, but it's an institution that must have as its end some notion of individuality, that is, the realization of the self, and therefore the notion of love may be a condition of the family, but it's not what the family is for. The family is constituted by many determinations that appear in it, and therefore, and love can't accommodate all of that. It can't accommodate all the various things that the family as a universal institution needs to do. Or to put it another way, the notion of love is notion of a feeling, and the notion of a feeling can't get the notion of universality necessary for the family as an institution. Well, it might be argued that the family is for the sake of reproducing economic life, but that turns out to be an illusion. Each family can only reproduce itself in a system of economic production that is wider than it. Indeed, that's part of what generates cities in the first place, that the idea of self-sufficient families as economic units broke down. Maybe the purpose of the family is for the education of children. Well, that will not work either, because male citizens are educated to become citizens, and that would mean that the family was not an equal structural moment, but really just a means to the ends of government. So if the thought is that a family is representing having its own weight and gravitas, it can't be a mere means to an end beyond itself. Hegel says something surprising and extraordinary. He says the real job of the family is to take care of the dead. It has as its object, I'm quoting, and content this particular individual who belongs to the family, but is taken as a universal being, free from his sensuous, i.e. individual reality. The deed no longer concerns the living, but the dead, the individual who, after a long succession of separate, disconnected experiences, concentrates himself into a single, completed shape, and has raised himself out of the unrest of the accidents of life into the calm of simple universality.
So where are you quoting from?
Is that for
451.
Thank you. In my case, it's from my manuscript. I take it that there are only, there's a great game in anthropology. Are there any persistent cross-cultural universes? Trans-historical, cross-cultural, you know, all of that. Well, I think there are two. I think all societies tell stories and all have rituals concerning the dead. Stories are, of course, about generationality, and so is the dead. That is, societies have to, in order to be a society, you've just got to figure out the relationship, your relationship to your immediate past. You have to have a way of inheriting the past, and therefore you have to have some relationship to your past, which is to say, to your dead. Our humanity is in some sense constituted by our relationship to the dead. The problem is what happens to someone once they are dead. Are they to become, I quote Hegel, an unreal, impotent shadow just because they are dead? Do they retreat immediately back into nature? But if they retreat immediately back into nature, then what does their life mean, or has it meant? Is life just an interruption in nature, which is itself nothing but a world of the dead? All death is finally natural death, because being dead is a natural state. If the range of questions I've just asked are to reverberate, and in some sense we can only make human life in general intelligible if we can conceive of individuals as being more than parts of nature as such. That is, we seem to be required to sustain, and it sustains the crux here, the excess of culture beyond nature. So the problem of the dead is the problem of the relationship between culture and nature. It's the problem of the autonomy or the relative autonomy of culture. But that relative autonomy is really very, very relative. People die. That's how we know it's that relative, right? But the fact is, we have to, and here's the thought, that is either a mere natural fact, in which culture becomes unintelligible to itself, or we have to make the fact of death itself a moment of culture. The other version of this is all that Levi-Strauss stuff on the raw and the cooked, right? Just the same problem. You need the stuff of the cooked, not because you can't eat raw food, but you've got to have some sense that eating and addition is more than a natural activity, right? Well, so is death and dying. The burial of the dead makes the individual as dead a continuing member of the community. That is, it gathers that individual up in their individuality. and therefore makes their death, transforms their death from fact to deed. It's as if all of history is just a little Fichtean moment of going from fact to deed. Right? We've got to make the fact of death into a deed of death. Not dying, but the death itself, by burial, becomes something done. And therefore, more than natural fact. Now, this is not to deny our place in nature. On the contrary, it's to acknowledge the limits of culture and, this is the crux of the matter, make the limits of culture belong to culture. Right? That is, you cannot have the limits of culture as wholly external, right? Or you've got a simple, right, absolute duality, which again renders life unintelligible or meaningless. So we acknowledge the limits of culture and make those limits belong to culture as such. Every act of burial is a fortiori, an act by which the dead becomes, in some sense, an immortal member of society. So the belief in immortality, I want to say, is in some sense a necessary belief. You cannot not believe in the immortality of the dead, otherwise you have no account of death. You just have an account of life and dust. Not death. Of course, you can misunderstand the meaning of that, right? We call that misunderstanding Christianity, right? But it's trying to think something serious. It's not, and the reason I think it has nothing to do, nothing, absolutely nothing to do with, as it were, just rewards beyond the world, or, you know, solace because life is hell and I'm going to live. That's not thinking about immortality. That's thinking about a better life. Right? Thinking about immortality is thinking about death. Only the dead can be immortal. And only if you're really dead can you be immortal. The Pope never invites me to dinner. Never. I don't know why. So, every act of burial is one in which the dead becomes an immortal member of society, and therefore the act through which society acknowledges its fundamental and irrevocable dependence on what is no longer living. It is a condition. It is the condition for the comprehension of the acknowledgement of the dependency of culture on nature, which is to say, on the past. All this is finally to say that we have the world we do only through our dead ancestors. And this raises a kind of aporia, because the dead, in one way, are never dead enough.
They weigh on us. They burden us. They never go away. On the other hand, they are always absolutely dead. Really dead. What do we owe the dead?
Well, my friend Gregor Harwood says, just the same as we owe the living. We owe them respect, acknowledgement, etc., etc.
Okay. This is the heart of the structural setup, which is trying to think through the family. Yeah. Yeah, please. I mean, I'm making a big theory about...
Because I'm curious to hear what you're going to say in response. But this idea that we need the dead, and I sort of want to understand better in what way. I mean, as far as I understand, the crux of the matter is, have you turned fact into deed?
Right.
As you said. So really what's at stake is action.
Yep.
And so for that, I mean, you're predicting Antigone as her instance. What she needs in order to act... kind of a literal banal sentence in terms of the prompt that's a stone structure is a corpse.
Right.
So, now why we want, are you saying that there's something more to the dead that we need other than the fact of their body that remains in its figure recognizability as her brother, that they've been devoured by vultures, so on and so forth? Or do we need all these other things that you just hinted at, recognition, respect, veneration, memory, they weigh on us, all these other things. That I'm not sure I get immediately. Well, why do we need that in order to turn back to
need? No, we don't need that, but that's the minimum necessary condition is we need the body and we need to bury it.
We need the body and we need to bury it.
We need to make fact into deed. Why do we need to make fact into deed? It's all that other stuff. So that other stuff is not...
Isn't only just an effect of that? I mean, in other words, isn't the centrality of the deed, from understanding, what generates these other effects? That they wouldn't weigh on us if the way that they do.
Absolutely, without the deed. No. The deed is what brings them into... So the necessity is the necessity of making the fact of death into a deed. Because we must do that, we get all the other stuff. But in getting the other stuff, we recognize, this is typical again, the meaning of the original necessity. Right? So that's the way the loop works. There's an original necessity that then works itself out. And of course, I mean, just to say the obvious here, this is a book that's going to say retrospection is necessary, right? This is a book about burying the dead, right? You may say the whole phenomenology is a claim that philosophy has forgotten to bury the dead, and therefore it's never been alive. It's always been a bit of a dead thing because it's thought of itself as cut off from its own spiritual conditions of possibility.
I mean, isn't the basic anxiety, though, before, I mean, I understand about retrospective and how those other problems get generated, but isn't the basic anxiety, I regard this corpse and I want to know that I'm more than simply that.
Oh, absolutely.
That I'm not just, as you were saying, dust to dust, decomposing corpse, worms will eat me, all that.
Right. In other words, right. I mean, that has to be, that's why I say you owe it the same as the living, right? Because you might say, leave them there, oh, he's died, oh, the birds come down, this, hold it. Why suddenly, just because they stop breathing, is all that okay? Right? Well, you can say, well, that's because they're now bits of nature. Oh, and what does that mean? Right? You know, you can just see how the problem's going to get going. We cannot make sense of caring about life unless we can make sense of death. Absolutely. In this way, right? This has nothing to do with Heideggerian being towards death, right? This just takes the fact of death as natural. That's its important fact. To think of it as something else
is fantasy land, right? That's part of, you know, Heidegger's heroic stuff.
This is the deep thing. Because it's not mine. It's about what I inherit.
My death is always easy. It's the other's death that's killing. Any other before I press on? So, I mean, this matters to the economy of this text,
because what we call,
I mean, we have these burial rites, but we have, you know, a language with it. So we call it grief and mourning, right? And grief and mourning is you know, and taking these problems.
You mentioned that my death is easy, and you mean, and also it's actually exactly the death of others and my death, because also the death of others, that's always the past, the my death, that's the future.
Right.
And also then I just so yeah, I don't know whether you can explain something. I think that's also Heidegger's death is rather means my death, and it's also actually in Antigone we can see that there's the because Antigone, when he did such burial, he actually, she's facing her own death. She knows that she's facing death. So actually, there's my death also in this part, and it's not easy,
of course. It's not, in fact, that's not whatever gives her a moment of consideration.
One would feel much easier about Antigone if she was a bit worried and a bit of self-interest. She says, well, if I do this, you know, I'm going to die. But no, it doesn't matter at all. And indeed, as I said, Lacan kind of goes the other direction and says, you know, she's death-driven. She's going to find a way to die no matter what, right? This is a girl headlong. So no, what I mean by that is I think of the issue of, you know, facing death, the way Heidegger talks about it, as something that happens when you're 16 years old. No, I mean this, it's a serious thing when you're 16 years old, because what you're actually thinking about is how you separate from your family. Right? The reason why every 16-year-old is a suicide is because every 16-year-old has to imagine their life apart from their place in their family. So, of course, they become obsessed with their death. Right? And that's necessary as part of this, of taking responsibility for one's own life. Right? But then one realizes that one's own life is not one's own life. It's the life one shares with others, and it's your care for them, and so on and so forth. Right? So I just think Heidegger got caught in an adolescent moment and just couldn't get out. He didn't imagine a way out. And I can give an account of why I think that's something to do with what happened to Germany because of the defeat in World War I and the settlement and all that. That there was a strangled... Germany wasn't allowed to become an adult. Right? That was the settlement after World War I. Infantilized, and that's what, you know, as I understand, that generation could not bear. So I think there's a reason why Heidegger had those theories, but I don't think of certainly when you get to my age, you know, my dad, worry about my kid, you know, everyone else's. That's a romantic moment. Hegel is no romantic. Okay, good. So, again, Hegel says, just very briefly, I won't read the whole passage, but 452, this universality which the individualist such attains is pure being, death. It is a state which has been reached immediately in the course of nature, not the result of an action consciously done, blah, 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 blah. So it's all about the relationship between fact and deed. Now, the beautiful harmony of Greece, so that the family had a role, an inalienable role, that is, apart from the whole business of matrilineal descent, it was the bearer of individuality. And the bearer of individuality in relationship, as we'll see, to the whole of an individual's life, which the state cares nothing about. I'll come to the why not in a moment. The beautiful harmony of Greece comes to an end with action, when somebody does something. Creon says that we have to honor the dead. The enemy is nothing to us. To allow them to bury their dead would be to presume that they deserve the same honor as our citizens. I'm quoting from the text. You must remember, it's often forgotten, that Polynices was a rebel. That he was attacking Thebes, right? And it was a family quarrel, right? He wanted to inherit. Polynices was not a good guy. And you don't get the frisson of the text if you consider him neutral or a good guy. Part of the weight of the text is the assumption, right? Seven against Thebes, that Polynices is a bad guy, in fact. And therefore that Creon had good reasons for not wanting him honored in the same way as he was going to honor those who had died for the sake of saving the city from rebels and renegades who wanted nothing but their, what, private self-interest. So he's not to be buried. Antigone immediately decides to bury her brother. And initially she does so in secret. She gets caught, and she is not willing to back down. Hence the law of the nation and the law of the family come into conflict with one another. They come into absolute conflict, and the tragic action foretells the collapse of this whole structure. So, what Hegel wants to think about, you have to be clear about what the stakes are here. He wants to understand. So it's clear we have a structural setup and a vision of a harmonious whole, and that at a certain moment, these two things that have previously been in equilibrium and harmony come into absolute conflict. Right? For Hegel, not for Sophocles, for Hegel, he wants to say, and the whole analysis depends upon this, that this conflict was inevitable, that there is a deep underlying structural flaw in this setup, and Antigone's action brings to light this structural flaw, and therefore what she does, the problem she reveals, cannot, in principle, be resolved in the Greek world. That is, her action blows the whistle on Greek ethical life, shows where its hollowness is, and therefore foretells its eventual collapse. Clearly doesn't bring it about. Bad politics brought it about. Going to wage wars in Sicily, places like that. Crazy stuff. Which Euripides kept telling them not to do, by the way. Okay, so what we have to do is track down
and I'm withholding here because I want to get to the right level of analysis rather than rumors about how this all works. We eventually have to track down where this structural flaw is. Well, what is it?
Yeah. One more naive question on this point, mm-hmm. which is the relationship between the inevitability of this collapse
right.
and her deed.
Right.
Which I can understand her deed as being the occasion, as it were, that brings the structural flaw to light, to the surface.
That's right. That's what he says.
So that much I understand, but to make it inevitable, maybe I've misread it, but to make it inevitable would seem in some way to devalue just how necessary the occasion of action is, such that it would have happened regardless, which I'm not sure is right.
No. The as we know, or we should know, from the Marx, right? Capital has insuperable structural contradictions. That doesn't mean it's ever going to collapse or go away. You can do think about bad marriages. You can figure out ways of patching up, going on, same things with bad society. The fact that a structural contradiction is revealed does not necessitate an empirical collapse. That's conflating two different levels of analysis. Right? People think because, capitalism has collapsed, Marx was wrong. That's just nuts. It's a misunderstanding of what it is to give an analysis of the internal contradictions of a social practice.
So what did you mean by inevitability? That was my question. I mean, I can see that the structural flaw that was from the start, but what was inevitable?
What was inevitable was that this harmony would break into disharmony. Right? Not that the whole thing would go away, but that in the same way that there would be crises, in another way. Crises can be patched up, but they are inevitable because there is a flaw. There's a problem that will always lead to conflict. Conflict does not necessarily generate collapse. That's why I said the conflict is inevitable and necessary, not the collapse. The mutual destruction of all the characters, of course, is the work of fate. Fate refers to the rationality of the whole, the logic of the whole through which lives become fate. Fate is what happens in actuality because of the inadequacy of the rationality of the whole. Once the deed is done, a passionate deed, it reveals a structural conflict, a diremption in the whole, which makes one part of the whole alien, or each part becomes alien to the other. Yet if each is dependent on the other, that's what I've tried to show, a mutual dependency, then in the deed you have alienated a part of yourself. Each of the parts is dependent on its place in the whole. Then when that deed comes about and each part becomes alien from the other part, it's not as if you have an external conflict. You have become alien to yourself. So, in the deed, you separate yourself from something which you are nonetheless intrinsically a part of.
Hegel thinks this operates for us just as much as it operated for Antigone. The transgressive actions are acts of both alienating yourself from a totality of which you are a part, and therefore always acts of self-alienation. Maybe here's a moment to have a quick break, and then I'll see if I can follow through on something.